Okay, we are ready to proceed with our last case to be orally argued today. If the clerk will call the case, please.
Court will now call Chase Eric Wheeler versus the state of Texas. May please the court. Mr. J. Daniel Clark will argue for the appellant. Michelle E. J. White will argue for the state.
Mr. Clark?
May it please the court. Counsel. This is an appeal of the trial court's denial of Mr. Wheeler's motion to suppress blood evidence. That blood evidence was obtained by a Pantego police officer pursuant to a purported blood search warrant. Now, this appeal presents a single question and involves three areas of law: Texas constitutional law, Texas statutory law, and a tradition of ancient law that dates back to the very beginning of recorded human history. That tradition is the giving of an oath. The idea that when we speak important words, consequential words, words that have legal significance, we swear to them under penalty of a power not of this earth. We swear under oath. In this case, the purported blood search warrant was entirely unsupported by oath. No oath of any kind occurred in this case. And it's our argument that the Texas statutory good faith exception in Code of Criminal Procedure Article 3823B cannot apply in this case, and therefore the blood must be suppressed under Article 3823A. Our argument proceeds in four steps. One, first, what the Texas Constitution requires for a warrant to issue in this state. Second, what violations of law occurred in this case when the officer drew Mr. Wheeler's blood. Third, what Article 3823A has to say about those violations. And fourth, why 3823B cannot apply here. So first, the Texas Constitution in Article 1, Section 9 very plainly states, no warrant shall issue unless three requirements are met. One, the warrant has to have particularity. Two, it has to have probable cause. And three, that probable cause must be supported by oath or affirmation. As I said before, there was no oath in this case, and therefore, under our state's highest law, no warrant issued.
Well, the piece of paper that he signed said it was under oath, and he signed it. I understand he was not sworn, but it says it was under oath, and there is case law that says that someone who signs something that says it's under oath can be held, can be found to have committed perjury for signing that when it says it was under oath.
That is correct, Justice Gabriel, but I believe in those cases there is at least some other evidence of an administration of an oath. And in fact, in the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in Smith versus State, you know, what the court said in that case was, as it relates to the oath, it's not the signature that's important. A signature is just a memorialization or evidence that an oath occurred. It is the actual giving of the oath, the swearing of the oath, that instills in the affiant the sense of moral obligation to tell the truth and instills within him a sense of seriousness and responsibility. In this case, there was no intention to give an oath, and it's not even clear that the officer knew that checkbox affidavit contained that statement. In other cases,
there's no evidence that he didn't know it either. So that's a nothing. We can't take that into consideration at all, can we?
To take the fact that
he knew or didn't know, we don't know. There's nothing in the record to support that one way or the other.
But what is in the record is the officer did testify that it was unsworn. He didn't swear to this warrant.
All right.
So at least by his own testimony, he said, I didn't swear to it, which may be some indication or inference that he wasn't aware that the affidavit contained that statement. And you are correct, Justice Gabriel. Certainly, one of the purposes of an oath is to subject the affiant to perjury. But again, I think on these facts, it's not crystal clear that this officer would have been subjected to perjury. But that is a secondary purpose of the oath. The primary purpose is, as the Court of Criminal Appeals has said, is to instill a sense of moral obligation to tell the truth, instill that sense of seriousness and responsibility. The Court of Criminal Appeals has also said in Clay versus State that an oath is both constitutionally and statutorily indispensable. And so that gets to, I might as well get to it right now, to step four of our argument as to why 3823B can't apply here. The Texas Constitution plainly says that no warrant in this state shall issue. 3823B's application is predicated on an issued warrant. So it's our argument that a magistrate can't issue a warrant that the Constitution prohibits the magistrate from issuing.
The warrant was issued in this case. I mean, it was signed by the judge. It was, in fact, served on Mr. Wheeler, and his blood was taken. So the warrant, I mean, I understand that it says it shall not, but it does not say it does not. It says it shall not. You can violate it, but it's still issued. It still happened. But you want us to disregard the fact that it actually happened.
Justice Gabriel, we respectfully disagree that, I mean, that piece of paper was no more a warrant than this piece of paper. I mean, it wasn't issued under our state's constitution. And as it relates to it being served on Mr. Wheeler, I don't think the record has any evidence of that. In fact,
his blood was drawn, was it not?
It was.
Okay.
But there's no evidence that the officer presented the warrant and served it upon Mr. Wheeler. In fact, that's one of our complaints as it relates to violation of Code of Criminal Procedure 1806B.
Would you give some examples of garden variety case where the exception would apply?
Certainly.
Good faith exception. In your mind, where would it apply?
It would apply in all of the cases that we cited our brief, and if you look at the case law, where it's being applied is in situations where there are statutory infirmities under 3823B. A perfect example is this court's decision in Crawford, which is an opinion you authored, Justice Gabriel. In that case, the officer swore to the contents of the affidavit before another officer. That's a constitutionally sufficient oath. The problem was that in Article, I think it's 1801B, the jurat, actually it wasn't clear what the defendant was arguing in Crawford. The problem was the jurat indicated that the officer had sworn to the affidavit before the judge, and that's not what occurred. But in Crawford, there was an oath. The officer swore to the affidavit before another officer. So if there was a problem with 1801B, or other statutory infirmity, then 3823B can be used to excuse those. But it's our position that it can't be interpreted to dispense with a constitutional warrant issuance requirement.
Okay, so let's just look at what to me is a really important factor anyway, and that is 3823B says, well, 3823A specifically refers to constitutional violations. 3823B says 3823A does not apply if. So how, I mean, you didn't attack that statute as unconstitutional, 3823B, that you can't trump the Constitution with a statute. You didn't attack it. It says what it says, and it says 3823A does not apply if it falls under the good faith exception. So just construing the statute as we are supposed to construe statutes, when it says A doesn't apply, how do you really get around that when A talks about constitutional issues?
We get around that by saying B only applies to A when it applies. 3823A was a statute that was passed in 1925, 12 or 14 years after the United States created the federal exclusionary rule in Weeks versus United States. That is a standalone statute that has been on the books for six decades prior to 3823B's passage. There are several ways you can violate 3823A constitutionally for which 3823B has no applicability.
Give me an example.
Okay.
Factually, don't cite a case. I want to hear a factual scenario.
If police officers conducted an in-person lineup of a subject after they've been indicted, that would violate the federal constitution. That would violate the Texas constitution. 3823B has nothing to say about that violation. If there was another Sixth Amendment right to counsel violation and somehow evidence was obtained, 3823B would have no applicability to that. You give me a minute, I think I have some other examples of that. If police officers, for example, obtained a coerced and involuntary confession, that would violate a defendant's due process rights under the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. 3823B would have nothing to say about that. So it's our view that at 3823A, that's the rule, and that's the rule that's been in place, and there are ways to violate it. 3823B can only excuse suppression under 3823 to the extent 3823A, to the extent it's applicable. And it's our position that it can't be applied if the Constitution prevents its application in that no warrant can issue under 3823B.
Okay. Article 1, Section 9 provides for an oath or affirmation, right?
Yes, Justice Basil.
1801 provides for a sworn affidavit.
Yes.
They're not the same thing, are they?
They're not the same thing.
Okay. How is an oath different from a sworn affidavit?
An oath, part of the issue about this case being a question of first impression for this court is it's not clear exactly what a constitutionally sufficient oath would be, but it certainly should be more than what occurred in this case. In the cases where there has been a violation under 1801B sworn affidavit requirement.
Now, I'm not worried about sworn affidavits right now. I'm worried about oaths. And the fact that this affidavit began with the words, "The undersigned defiant, a peace officer under the laws of the state of Texas, and after first being duly sworn," which apparently didn't occur, "on oath makes the following statements and accusations. The fact that someone says that I am making this on an oath is not sufficient in your view."
I don't think it's sufficient if there's other evidence in the record that the individual testified that he didn't make the statement under oath. And I think the case...
Did he testify he didn't make a statement under oath, or did he testify he was never sworn?
He testified it was unsworn. I didn't swear it. The magistrate testified that it was unsworn. He testified that in 14 months as a police officer, he never swore to search warrant affidavits.
So something to the effect that this was policy as far as he knew?
He believed that he didn't have to follow or have to swear his affidavits under oath because the Pantego Police Department didn't train him on that. So he thought he was following policy by doing what he did here. And he was trained that...
Is there any testimony on the record that there have been other cases out in Pantego where similar situations have happened? In other words, is this policy? Do we have any, or is this just situation involving this officer?
The only evidence that this is policy was based on this officer's testimony. So, when the state didn't pursue that any further in questioning.
And tell me exactly what he said with regards to... What were his exact statements?
Exactly. I'd have to actually look at the record, but I believe he said he believed he was following Pantego Police Department standard procedures when he did what he did here and didn't swear to it. So.
And that doesn't get him under at 3823?
It doesn't get him under 3823?
That doesn't indicate that he's operating under a good faith belief under 3823?
Well, I mean, it has to be an objective good faith belief, Justice Basil. So, I mean, if take it to the extreme, let's assume a police department trains its officers that they don't have to, affirmatively trains them that they don't have to swear to things under oath. I don't think that would get him out of
And belief. I might agree with you about that, but that's not what happened here. I mean, if you look at the Longoria case, it said Officer Greenhill's trial testimony reflected his belief that he complied with the requirements of the law and that there was nothing about the search warrant that may have caused him to believe that the warrant issued by a neutral magistrate based on probable cause was invalid. Didn't the officer's belief in this case reflect that same conclusion?
I don't agree that it does.
Why?
Longoria... The record showed that the officer appeared before a second officer, signed his affidavit before the second officer, and both the affiant officer and the notarizing officer, there was testimony in the record that both of those officers intended that act to be an oath. This officer didn't appear before any other official, an officer, a notary public. A magistrate had no intention of administering an oath in this case. You know, her testimony was that she believed the officer had sworn to it before a second officer or a notary. And we know that that didn't occur here.
Well, tell me, this isn't in the briefs, but I'm curious about under Article 1801 B2, apparently talking about the issuance of warrants by electronic means. It says, if an applicant for search warrant attests to the contents of an affidavit submitted by a reliable electronic means, the magistrate must acknowledge the attestation in writing on the affidavit. So what does that require?
I believe that's 1801 B1, Justice Basil. And that statute was passed after the Court of Criminal Appeals decision in Clay, dealing with telephonic warrants. And so, you know, 1801B, we believe, is intended to cover a situation where an officer swears his affidavit under oath to another officer or a notary and then transmits the contents of that affidavit to the magistrate, and that's an acceptable way for the magistrate to review an affidavit. And if you look in 1801B, it specifically states that if the magistrate wants to take more testimony, that he or she is supposed to place the officer under oath. So don't think that 1801B creates any problems for our argument here. I believe my time has expired.
It is. Thank you. Ms. White?
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Shelby White, and today I represent the state. I think the issue before the court today is whether an unsworn affidavit can support a blood warrant under the good faith exclusionary rule, a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. And I think kind of the main fact that we need to keep in mind here is that no one is disputing the contents of the affidavit. No one is alleging that Officer Bonner lied on the affidavit, that what he said happened in the affidavit didn't actually happen or he didn't actually observe it. And no one is saying he didn't take his duty seriously as a police officer, or that the warrant was not, that the magistrate was not neutral in this case, that it wasn't issued by a neutral magistrate. The only allegation here is that Officer Bonner didn't fill out the affidavit form correctly. And so this comes down to an issue of, did you fill out the form right? And that's exactly the scenario that the good faith exception is meant to cover. the ultimate issue here, I think.
Does it make any difference that the officer also testified this was standard operating procedure in his office? In other words, when we typically think of an exception, you think of a one-time mistake, out of the norm. Here it sounds like this was what they did in every case.
I think, so I would like to dispute, the officer doesn't, there's no one else from the police officer, the police department that testifies this is our standard procedure and that this is what he was taught. He said, this is what I understood it to be, this is what I was taught, and that's pages 19 and 20 of volume 2.
The only testimony that we do have is that this is what he was taught and this is the way they did it.
And he kind of admits, now I know that I'm wrong about it, but he testifies he learned in the police academy what an oath was, and that he's in Pantego, you know, he's the one working the night shift, it's only him and the dispatcher, and he thought this is how it was handled, that he just signed it and sent it off to the magistrate.
And I guess let me tell you the reason why I'm asking this question. At a certain point, the exception can become the rule.
Yes.
And if admittedly it was not done, the oath was not taken, it's unsworn in this case, it was admittedly done wrong. If that's the standard operating procedure based on the evidence that we had, how can this be an exception if that's the way it's done every single time?
Well, I think that gets to point two, which is our kind of the perjury argument, that the solemnity of the oath and what it represents and what the Constitution requires, and this is going to be kind of a long-winded answer getting back to your original question. What the Constitution requires is just that you take an oath or an affirmation. It does not specify you need to raise your right hand, you need to put your left hand on the Bible, you need to say the words X, Y, Z. It just says you need to take an oath. And so courts have said, how do we determine whether or not an oath was made? The purpose of the oath is to solemnize the occasion, to kind of bring home the importance of what you're doing and the importance of telling the truth. And so to determine whether an oath was made, we say, are you subject to perjury? And statutes 3702 and then 3707 say you're subject to perjury if it says it was made under oath. And so here we have an affidavit that says it was made under oath. And so Officer Bonner would be subject to perjury not only if you just look strictly at the affidavit, because but then also when he doubles down on his statements, he says, this is exactly what happened, this is what I understood happened, and I told the truth at the hearing. And he's subject to perjury, and he's under oath then. And you'll look at situations where, for example, a child is testifying or someone who's mentally incompetent wants to testify before the court, and they obviously don't understand necessarily what raising your right hand and putting your left hand on the Bible means, but the judge will ask, do you understand what the truth is? Do you understand what a lie is? Do you understand the importance of telling the truth here? And then the judge can determine, even though you haven't fulfilled, you know, this kind of formulaic requirement of what an affidavit is or what an oath is, you are under oath here because you understand the importance of telling the truth. And so in this situation, even though we have maybe a defective form and maybe we have an officer that didn't fill out the form correctly one time or multiple times, he is subject to perjury, and we would argue that he really has, in essence, taken an oath. What has ultimately happened is he understands the solemnity of the occasion, he understands the importance of telling the truth, he says he told the truth.
So that the magistrate could have questioned him?
Yes, I think so.
That's enough to get you there?
Yes, and then...
That fits you into the example you gave with the child or incompetent person?
Yes, exactly. That it's not about the formulaic requirements, it's about, do you understand what this represents, and are you agreeing to tell the truth here?
It's your position that merely stating that merely stating on oath makes the following statements and accusations constitutes an oath?
Yes, and so I did not cite it in our brief, and I'm sorry I don't have the citation for it, but it's Hardy v. State, which is a Court of Criminal Appeals case from 2007, and I can send a copy to opposing counsel in this court afterwards, but that is a case that comes dealing with 3707 and 3702, and what happens is you have a police officer, or a sheriff, who has been lying on affidavits kind of for the purpose of getting people in trouble that he doesn't like, and someone else has signed, you know, I witnessed him making this oath in front of me, and so it comes out that he's been lying on these affidavits, goes to trial, and he's being tried for perjury for these false affidavits, and no one testifies, you know, the sheriff stood in front of me and made this oath in front of me, and I saw him make the oath. There's no testimony about that, and so the sheriff tries to say, because there was no testimony that I actually made the oath, you have no proof that I made the oath. And the court says, it doesn't matter because your affidavit said you made the oath. That's enough. And we don't care. We don't need the testimony from your notary or from your magistrate, whoever you swore in front of. We don't need that. It's enough that you said you made the oath. And that's the exact scenario we have here. He said he made the oath. He signed it, and that's enough. I think... kind of tracking back to what was going to be my original question, the intersection between statutes and the Constitution. I think that's something the court has asked about earlier in appellant's argument. There are numerous statutes that address what the remedy is going to be for constitutional violations, and that's not anything that anyone really has a problem with. And the legislator has determined that there are some constitutional violations that don't warrant a remedy. So, for example, if we look at qualified immunity for government actors, sovereign immunity, the good faith exception, searches incident to arrest, the reason is because courts ultimately have a truth-telling function, and we don't want to hinder that just because there has been an innocent mistake or a mistake that was not ill-intentioned, it was not malicious. And the courts have said the exclusionary rule is a drastic remedy. In Thornton v. State, the Court of Criminal Appeals says, because of its substantial interference with the criminal justice system's truth-finding function, the application of the exclusionary rule should be restricted to those areas where its remedial objectives of deterring future unlawful police conduct are best served. And so that's where the good faith exception comes back in. The exclusionary rule says, yes, there was a constitutional violation, we acknowledge it, and the good faith exception says, yes, but there's not a remedy in this case. We're still going to let this evidence in because the violation that occurred is not as important to us as the truth-finding function in this case. And so the exclusionary rule is really, as I mentioned earlier, it's meant to deter those instances where someone was malicious or ill-intentioned, where an officer did lie on an affidavit, where an officer misrepresented what they saw, but not a situation like this where the officer says, I thought I was doing the right thing. I took the steps I understood I needed to take. I went and got a warrant. I had a neutral magistrate issue it. I wrote down what I saw and I told the truth. I just didn't fill out the form correctly. And that's the kind of exception that That's the kind of situation the good faith exception is meant to apply to.
Well, I understand that, and I understand your point. But, you know, if I get stopped going 65 in a 55-mile-an-hour zone where your officer, I thought that the speed limit was 60, I'm not sure if the good faith exception would apply for me. I mean, to a certain extent, we have these rules for a reason. Mm-hmm. And the concern that I have is this is the procedure every single time. In this police department, it's done the wrong way. I do have a concern that the exception is becoming the rule. And if you let it pass in this time, does that mean that everybody has carte blanche to do this and every time this case comes before us before?
And that's, I think, where you run into an issue of, has it crossed the line from being an honest mistake into being malicious or being intentional? And you know you're making a mistake and you're continuing to do it anyways because you can get away with it. And so the exclusionary rule would apply in those situations where you're malicious about it, where you don't, you know you're doing something wrong, as opposed to, I mean, we have Officer Bonner here who's a rookie cop, year one, by himself on the night shift and just honestly doesn't know any better. And I think if he had known better, he never would have done it.
Was there evidence? So his testimony was, as far as he knew, this was standard procedure. Nobody had told him any different.
Yes.
Was there evidence that this, in fact, was standard procedure of the Pantego Police Department or any other police officer did this ever? Or is it just evidence that he was mistaken?
It's evidence that he was mistaken. There is no one from the police department that testified this is that would have been qualified to testify this is what our standard procedure is, this is what we teach people. He testifies, this is what I knew and this is what I thought I was supposed to do. But there is not any testimony about what the true police procedure is and what he was taught necessarily. And I think that we do have, to some extent, we have the magistrate, Judge Del Carmen, who testifies, you know, I worked for several other police departments and this is not what I usually saw. This is not what I usually got, and that's why I signed it, because I didn't expect it. You know, it was 3 a.m. in the morning, and I didn't look and notice that I was signing saying he swore in front of me. I thought I was signing as the magistrate and that there was already another notary signature, because that's what I normally got. So I think in terms of evidence that this is some sort of police department-wide problem, there's not any sort of indication that that's the truth. It's just kind of his personal misunderstanding. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the two cases, the Longoria case and then the Ashcroft case, which appellants had mentioned in their reply brief. So the Longoria case is what we cited in our brief, and in that case, both of those cases basically exactly mimic our facts, and they're from the Austin Court of Appeals. Longoria's post-dates the appellant's briefing, but then Ashcroft is prior to theirs. So it's from 2013. And they mimic the scenario that we have here, which is what appellants are calling unsworn or no oath at all. And in that case, in Longoria, the police officer pulls someone over, suspected DWI, and he handwrites out an affidavit, and he does not include oath-affirming language. He has, you know, just, this is what I saw, and then his partner also signs it as the notary, but both officers admit we didn't swear an oath. There was no oath at all. No one did any of this kind of oath-taking process. And so then at trial, the officer the original affidavit-making officer testifies, I didn't swear it under oath, but I understood what I was doing. I understood that I was telling the truth. I told the truth, and I understood that I would be subject to perjury. In the Longoria, the Austin Court of Appeals says that's enough. Even though you didn't actually do any of the oath-taking procedure, even though there is not an oath in your affidavit, the fact that you thought you were subject to perjury and you understood that and you told the truth is enough for us. And then Ashcroft, the officer suspected DWI, pulls this guy over, takes him to the hospital and wants a blood draw, and he has a pre-printed affidavit form, the same as we have here, which has oath-affirming language at the top. And he says, oh, I need someone else to sign this for me, calls another police officer over. That police officer signs, but same scenario, they both agree. No one did anything that was remotely oath-like at the time. And the Austin Court of Appeals again says, in that case, we don't even need to look at whether you thought you were subject to perjury because the affidavit says you were, and that's enough for us. And therefore, the good faith exception applies. So both of those cases that mimic our facts in terms of no oath, no proper procedure followed, that's enough for them. The good faith exception applies when you have that oath-affirming language or you have an officer that testifies, I thought I was under oath. And so I think those two cases are certainly very persuasive for this court in terms of, I know this is first impression for this court, but other courts have looked at this issue and held that it's fine. And this kind of distinction that appellants have tried to draw between no oath versus defective oaths, I think ultimately what we're looking at is just an issue of, did you fill out the form right? Did you follow this procedure, or did you do something similar? Or in this case, when you have that oath-affirming language, is that enough? And courts have held that it is enough. And so I see that my time is wrapping up here. So unless there's no further questions, for those reasons and the reasons laid out in our brief, we would ask that this court affirm the trial court's judgment and hold that the good faith exception applies and that the warrant in this case is valid.
Thank you. Mr. Clark?
The Texas Constitution has nothing to say about how you fill out the forms. At the beginning of the state's argument, she said we're arguing that he didn't fill out the form properly. We're not arguing that. We're arguing there was no oath here. As far as Longoria and Ashcraft go, we don't think the facts mimic this case. In Longoria, you had the officer signing the affidavit in front of a second officer. And in that case, both officers testified that, and just the same thing that happened in Ashcraft, even though they didn't verbally administer an oath, by what they were doing, both of those officers understood that to be swearing it under oath.
Did Longoria really turn on the application of the oath, or did it turn on the fact that the officer said, I signed the affidavit swearing and affirming everything, then the affidavit was true and correct to the best of my knowledge, that signed it where it says that. And then he says, I signed the affidavit swearing that everything in it was true, simply because he had expressed something that was tantamount to an oath in that document. That was sufficient and gave him an objective good faith belief that the warrant properly issued.
I think that's correct, that he testified he understood that document to be him swearing to it under oath. And we don't have that here.
But I don't mean to be argumentative with you, sir, but why don't we have that here when he says on oath makes the following statements and accusations?
Because he testified that he didn't swear to it under oath. That's a boilerplate packet, checkbox packet.
If I sign a document that says that what I'm stating is under oath, that I have to say I really meant it before it becomes an oath?
No, but if you believed that you weren't swearing under oath, even though you signed a document that said it and then you testified, I wasn't swearing to it under oath.
In this record, the officer said, he used the words, I didn't believe I was signing this document under oath.
The officer said this affidavit was unsworn. And the state elicited no testimony as to what his subjective beliefs were as to what he was doing in this case.
But unsworn and an oath are two different things, aren't they?
I believe you absolutely have to have an oath for something to be sworn. But
do you have to have a swearing to have an oath?
Well, a verbal swearing, a written swearing, I'm not sure I'm following the question.
If you sign a document that says, I am signing this document under oath.
But what if you didn't know that? What if the document was just in front of you and you thought that per police procedure, all you needed to do was fill out this warrant form, like a waiter filling out a ticket for a short order cook, and drop it off on the dispatcher's desk never to see it again? I just think, Justice Basil, if you get really engaged with the facts here, it gets to what Justice Pittman has said. I mean, the rule is, I mean, the exception has swallowed the rule. And in Justice Dolfino's concurring opinion, in Justice Gabriel's Crawford opinion, this was exactly what she alluded to several years ago, that the good faith exception has no boundary. And our argument is that it does have at least one boundary, and that should be what the plain text of the Texas Constitution requires. And so whether something was properly sworn or sworn, or the difference between a swearing or an oath. I mean, there has to be some form of oath, is our opinion. We all took oaths. We swore under oath when we were attorneys. You swore under oath upon your investitures of this court. And maybe in this day and age, that seems anachronistic, but we still do it. And this, you look at State's Exhibit 5, and you look at the facts of what happened here. I mean, is this what's, you just fill it out and you hand it off to the dispatcher, and then you go draw guys in blood?
No, you get back something from a neutral and detached magistrate that says you can do that.
And in this case, it's not even clear that the officer ever received it back. The dispatcher told him.
Well, what case law says he, as long as he knows that it's been issued and he's been told that it's been issued, wouldn't a reasonably prudent law enforcement officer be able to rely upon that?
I believe a reasonably prudent law enforcement officer would comply with 1806B and serve the warrant, show the warrant on the person about he's to conduct the search on.
And where is that required?
1806B of the Code of Criminal Procedure.
And you're saying that then there's no exception to that ever?
There may be, Justice Gabriel, but you just asked me what do I think a reasonable officer would do.
Okay.
I think that would be the
case. That's fair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. It's a very interesting issue, clearly, and we appreciate your briefing and your arguments. It's been very helpful. Your case is submitted.